It's time for Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt with us and joining us on the telephone, an author who was with us just a few weeks back talking about his newest book, Escape from Castro's Cuba. But because around here, downtown refuses to be bound by this notion of time being strictly linear, we're going to go back and talk about his wonderful previous book, Castro's Curveball. Tim Wendell joins us. Tim, welcome back.
Hey, great to be back with you guys.
Well, we loved, even though we didn't read them in the proper order, we absolutely loved Castro's Curveball, another terrifically entertaining, incredibly researched book that took me personally back to a time that I didn't know all that much about, and it really opened up the history of Cuba to me, in addition to the baseball and the great story.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, people kind of forget that before the revolution in Cuba, we're talking 59-60 when Castro takes over, pretty much Havana was Vegas before Vegas. Mm. This is where everybody took the night ferry down from Miami or Key West, only 90 miles away, and, you know, maybe did a walk on the wild side. As, as they say, Cuba's saying, what, so foreign and yet, you know, and yet so close. So that's very much what it was, 30s, 40s, 50s. And it's funny, I was just thinking when you were bringing that up, guys, that if you still go to the National Hotel, and I've been down to Cuba four times since 92, you go in the main lobby, and there's these huge black and white photographs of, Humphrey Bogart with Lauren Bacall, and, oh, here's George Raft, and here's Ernest Hemingway, and you go, wow. Yeah, this is where all the beautiful people used to come.
One of the things I was thinking about when I was caught in the longest traffic jam in the history of I-95 a couple weeks ago in Virginia was I had been in the express lane. I got off to go to a rest area, found I couldn't get back in the express lane. So immediately I said to myself, what if I had stayed in the express lane? And that reminded me of those great Saturday Night Lives. What if Napoleon had B-52s at Waterloo, what if Eleanor Roosevelt could fly, you know, those sort of absurd things. But you pose a question in your book that's really a very serious question on one level is, what if Castro had chosen baseball and been good enough to make it? How different would our world be today? How long did it take you from the first notion you had that to say, I got to write that book?
Pretty much, you know, I had heard guys that Castro was interested in baseball. I mean, it always been rumored, you know, and I was covering the baseball beat for Baseball Weekly at USA Today that, you know, the Cuban national team was great. Supposedly Castro was the de facto general manager, and that's where I kind of left it. And it wasn't really till that first trip down in 92 and then subsequent trips later in the 90s where you'd hear from Cubans talking about Castro's love for the game and how he was so infatuated with it as a kid. He was a very good athlete, you know, our equivalent to being in high school. And, you know, was he top-grade baseball talent? No. But a guy that took over the island like he did, landing on this cabin cruiser, looks like something from Gilligan's Island, and then 3 years later takes over the island, if he wanted to pursue baseball, and supposedly he was kind of going back and forth between that and revolution, I'm not going to sell him short, but one thing he did do that was remarkable, that is certainly borne out and unfortunately had a huge consequence for Cuba as a nation, is after they took control in 59, one of the first things Castro did was form a baseball team, and he's going to barnstorm the island. They called themselves Los Barbaros. And I've still got a cap here, baseball cap, that has that old insignia. Los Barbaros means the bearded one. And of course, everybody in the Revolutionary Army had beards. And they toured the island, and the people absolutely loved it. Che Guevara supposedly played second base. Supposedly was terrible. But of course, Castro had the pitch, and he pitched all these games, and they went up one end of the island, down the other. And people still talk about that barnstorming tour, how they felt they had gotten a leader who understood their passion for the game and how much they loved it, how much baseball is a part of their soul.
There were always baseball players who had played in Cuba in the winter leagues or had gone down there when the Sugar Kings were pretty active, who talked about how much fun it was to play in Cuba, that the people knew the game, they liked that. You bring Dick Hoke into the book, and guys that I remember, because I'm the oldest one in the conversation here. But how much opportunity did you have to talk to people that had actually played in Cuba?
Oh, a fair amount, and helped me set kind of the backdrop for what happens in Castro's curveball, because that winter ball league, again, this is all before the revolution, was the place to be in the winter. You know, if you're like Billy Bryan, the narrator in the novel, he's trying to resurrect his career. If you're like a player is just trying to get, you know, tuned up and ready for another successful season, you know, everybody played there, even though it was only four teams, really. And the list goes on and on. I've talked to Tommy Lasorda, in passing, Jim Bunning, Willie Mays, had an in-depth conversation with Brooks Robinson. This is just a small sample of the U.S. major leaguers that were down there and not only went there to tune up their game, but went there because it was Vegas before Vegas, but also they just had, the Cuban people know the game. And you talk to ball players, that's something they always appreciate, is if you're playing in front of a crowd that really knows the nuances. And frankly, that conversation with Brooks Robinson was really one of the beginning points with the book. I'd come back from 92, that first trip, and I'm going, this could be interesting. I'd never written a novel, and I'm going, I need a little bit backstory. And that conversation with Brooks about his time playing down there was just great.
We're talking with Tim Wendell here on Downtown about his book, Castro's Curveball. Castro is such an interesting and charismatic character in the book. How much of that was poetic license, and how much of that was what you learned about him in your trips to Cuba as a person?
It was healthy doses of both, guys, but what I read three major biographies of Castro, but I was still having a difficult time, you know, how I'm going to treat him as a character. And I think people that, you know, read the novel find, you know, he's not a hero, that's for sure, but he's not the devil incarnate either. And I was really struggling at that point. Okay, how's this going to fall? And I'm dealing with a real life guy, you know, and I'd read Don DeLillo's Underworld, you know, the opening there, the shot, you know, the homer hit around the world with Bobby Thompson. And I'm just trying to puzzle it out. And I reread The Great Gatsby, in part because I was now doing first person in the voice of this washed up catcher in the Washington Senators organization, Billy Bryan. And I hadn't written a lot of first person. And I dove into it, and I'm kind of going, oh, this is how Fitzgerald's doing this, you know, how he's going, you know, how the voice is strong sometimes, the Nick Carraway voice. Other times it fades back and the scenes just roll out. It's amazing tour de force, obviously, that Fitzgerald does. But I hit that part toward the end of the novel of Gatsby. And I don't know the verbatim. I can't quite quote it. But he's talking about Daisy and Tom. And in a sense, Gadsby's dead, I believe, at this point. And they've left Long Island. They've left the East Egg or whatever. And Nick is just talking about them as people. And he's talking about how they were just so sure of themselves that they just barreled ahead into anything. And they never looked back at what kind of havoc or trouble or just, you know, upheaval that they created. And I remember hitting those lines and going, that's it. That's the way I want my Castro character to be. He's going to be so sure of himself, and he's sure no saint, but he never looks in the rearview mirror. And at that point, I felt like I had a pretty good bead on him, at least the way I wanted to present him.
Well, what I love about the way he functions and with Billy as the first person narrator is that everybody we learn about, Malena Fonseca, Castro, anybody else, we learn about through Billy's eyes. And as we see, Billy is sometimes a very astute judge of character, and sometimes he's a little bit behind the curve. And I thought that what made the book seem so human to me. I mean, as a writer myself, I said, you know, this is the way to do this. This doesn't work in third person. This is never going to be a third person limited narration. This has to come from Billy. And I just thought you did a remarkable job of inhabiting him. And he's...
Thank you.
You know, and that's not an easy thing to do. I give seminars on that all the time, and most of my students don't get there. So whenever I see it really done really well, I say, yeah, that's a way to do it. Now I can tell them, buy this book and you'll find out how.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because a lot of this novel originally, I probably should have been in your class. I didn't know what the heck I was doing, you know, way back when I was doing this book. It was written in third, and I found it was kind of flat. It didn't have the insight into Cuba, even Castro, even though I was struggling to line him up. And I used to write at this point in my life, this is a long time ago, this is decades ago, but the only time I had to write was on the D.C. Metro, the subway. And I had roughly 20, 25 minutes from, you know, when I parked the car and then got on the subway. And one day I got my only requirement was to write a page in my notebook. I just use spiral notebooks. I don't use Moleskin and all that stuff. That's intimidating to me. And so I got on one day, and it was already a bad day, and I'm not quite sure why. And I decided, forget it. You know, I'm not going to write today. This day's already gone downhill, even though it's 8:30 in the morning. And I got roughly halfway to my stop, to the USA Today building, and I started feeling very guilty. I got out my notebook and I wrote very quick, and I just wrote down what I like to feel is a first person voice that's more naive and desperate than my own. And then, whoops, here's my stop. Time to go to work. It's time to make the money. And it wasn't until I got home that night and I looked at that page, and I went, I really like this voice. And it became the voice of Billy Bryan. And after the novel originally came out, I was somewhere, I think in New York, NYU or something, and somebody got up and was asking some questions, or it was question time about the novel. And she said, I don't care about Castro. I don't care about Winter Ball and Cuba. I don't care about, you know, Cuba being Vegas before Vegas, all these other things you're talking about. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is going to be an interesting question. But then she said, that voice. I'd follow that voice, the voice of Billy Bryan, anywhere. And I went, thank you. You know, because I was just thinking, thank God I opened up my notebook that day. You know, because I think, as you guys well know, the writers I admire, they come to it with a great deal of regularity. And some days it really works. It's great. Other days it's like jumping off a cliff and you plummet. And but you only find like a voice of Billy Bryan if you open up your notebook on the days you don't really feel like writing.
Well, what we also appreciated, Bruce and I have both coached and been around athletes our whole life. We both appreciated the fact that how true the dialogue rang when it came to the ball players and the way they talk with each other.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I've hung around some clubhouses. I probably could have put in a little bit more profanity, but it's this world, you know, and I always find the baseball world, especially when I was on the beat, you know, first in San Francisco and then nationally for USA Today, just to be this very interesting kind of club. And I've always been struck, and Billy is an example of it in Castro's Curveball, to what extent these ball players will go to stay in this world, in a sense, to stay a part of baseball. You know, you hear within baseball, yeah, he's a baseball lifer. And the ones that are typified as that, or, you know, in a sense, fall into that designation, will go to great, great lengths to stay in baseball. And that's, in a sense, one of the pivot points early on in Curveball. I mean, it's like, hey, here's this potential phenom or prospect named Castro. Billy only starts to pursue him because it's an end to a means, or a means to an end. It allows him to stay in the game. You know, it's been kind of laid out to him. Hey, if you're able to maybe sign this guy, maybe you've got a future as a scout or something like that. And that's something that always struck me all the years I was covering baseball as a beat. And I think I probably fell into that for a while too. It's just the extent people will go to simply be a part of this world, a part of this game.
Well, I used one of Tony Kornheiser's favorite words. The sense of verisimilitude throughout these two books was just really, really, it was great. It was fun. It made me stay engaged. And I certainly look forward to reading some of your other work. before too long, and having you back with us, and we're just so glad you could be part of this. And I want people to know that Castro's Curveball and Escape from Castro's Cuba, both available from the University of Nebraska Press, one of our favorite presses. So everybody who's listening, if you haven't read them yet, go out and get them.
Thanks, guys. Always great to be on with you.
Appreciate it, Tim. Thanks again. We'll do it before too long.
Oh, please. Let's do it.
You bet.
It's a date. That's Tim Wendell with us on Downtown Sports Lit 101.